Good morning. It's been a great pleasure for me to be here at Truett Seminary. I'm so impressed with the students with whom I've chatted and the faculty and your physical facilities and the fact that it's 40 degrees warmer here than in Boston. So I'll be going back tonight to the Frozen Four as our BU hockey team is competing for its championship. So from basketball to hockey. But I'm very pleased to be here for the third Parchman lecture. The topic is postcolonial friendships in the age of revolution. I've been working through the 20th century looking at the theme of friendship, and last night I looked primarily at theologies of fellowship in the 1920s. And now I'm moving forward past the World War II era. A revolution is not a dinner party, or writing an essay, or painting a picture, or doing embroidery. It cannot be so refined, so leisurely and gentle, so temperate, kind, courteous, restrained, and magnanimous. A revolution is an insurrection, an act of violence by which one class overthrows another. This quotation by Mao Zedong encapsulates the challenges for cross-cultural friendship in the mid-20th century. Nationalist movements rejected and fought against European colonial powers. In 1947, India and Pakistan were separated in the largest mass migration in history as 14 million Muslims and Hindus fled into separate homelands. Communist victory in China meant that by 1953, Christians were considered bad elements who needed to be disciplined by the people. In Latin America, the increasing militarization of the state resulted in violent struggle between military coups allied with autocratic states and leftist student movements. In South Africa and the United States, civil rights movements were empowered, but those also divided and consumed churches. Fear of the Soviet Union terrified Americans. The U.S. was becoming a world power. These were some of the things happening in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Now, in 1962, when I was a child in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, our school field trip was to tour a bomb shelter because we expected to be bombed with a nuclear bomb by Cuba. And we hid under our desks for bomb drills during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So the Cold War was the context for mission. What happens to cross-cultural friendships in an era like that? Well, I'm using the word postcolonial in two senses here. First, a chronological description of this period of history in which European colonialism ended and we move into the period of the Cold War and beyond. Secondly, I'm using it in a more missiological sense or spiritual sense as an attitude of humility that rejected being in mission from a position of power and privilege. This period of history was challenging for cross-cultural friendships. In the cauldron of the Cold War, yesterday's friend was today's collaborator. People who had been lauded as bridge figures between East or West, North or South, were newly judged as sellouts and assimilationist traitors. Well-meaning Westerners, including missionaries, had to learn the hard lesson that speaking on behalf of the other was not really friendship if the Westerner remained in power. So what used to pass for friendship now looked like paternalism. And you see the missionary community splitting and torn apart by world events in the 1960s. Some missionaries who sympathized with national independence movements were quickly accused of being communists. Asians and Africans who befriended Western missionaries looked like the running dogs of imperialism. And the U.S. became a global superpower. Thus, missions from the U.S. looked like a code language for paternalism and colonialism and for U.S. intervention in Vietnam, Cuba, Chile, the Philippines, and other places. So you could argue that the most popular mission phrase of the late 1960s and early 70s was, missionary, go home. So it was a period of struggle for mission theology as well. And yet, the ideals and commitment to cross-cultural friendships persisted. The practice of it became even more complicated. So what this post-colonial lens tells us about mission is that there's no such thing as cheap friendship. Those who persisted in cross-cultural relationships during this Cold War period made hard choices. They paid high prices for being friends. Being a friend with someone from another culture often meant inhabiting the uneasy liminal space, the space between, in which loyalty to one's own ethnicity or country of birth and loyalty to one's friends were pitted against each other. So the post-colonial reality required a new level of risk of self-emptying. It meant being misunderstood and marginalized by geopolitical forces beyond one's control and increased the risk of martyrdom. So revolution was no dinner party. It was not a place where friends could easily sit around a table. In this lecture, thus, I will like to examine just three aspects of cross-cultural friendship from this post-colonial context and spirituality during the period of Cold War and revolution. So first, I will look at friendship as exile. And of course, I'm not being exhaustive here. There are many aspects of friendship, but there's three that I've chosen to look at. Mission as exile, in which friendship resulted in exile. Second, a movement in mission theology and practice from paternalism to partnership. That was a product of the post-colonial era of mission. And then finally, ecumenical frameworks for the task of self-theologizing. So those are the three subjects I'd like to address under this category of post-colonial mission. First, friendship as exile. And I'm just going to use the example of China and Cold War politics. By the late 1940s, there was actually great enthusiasm and possibility thinking about Christianity being a genuinely worldwide multicultural movement. And you have a period of optimism after World War II. 1948 was the year the World Council of Churches was founded and the United Nations. And those things had a lot in common with each other. So there was a tide of optimism about a possibility of a new world order. But geopolitical changes turned friendship on its head. Instead of a place to be at home, being a friend might mean being in exile. Friendship as exile meant could mean marginalization and inhabiting that liminal third space between cultures. So let's look at Mao's China as probably the most famous example in which the missionary community was forced into exile, and many people were in exile. With the victory of the communists and the outbreak of the Korean War in 1950, missionaries and Chinese Christians were condemned as imperialists. All missionaries were expelled or arrested in China. 400,000 Chinese Christians signed the Christian Manifesto that condemned the church as an imperialist entity. So Chinese Christians themselves needed to make a statement against the Western connections that they had prized often. Association with Westerners became dangerous, and you have people, letters from Chinese Christians saying, you know, we love you, but please don't contact me again, that kind of thing, because of the suspicion around any connection with the West. So the church in China is cut off from the West, And during the Cultural Revolution of between 1966 and 76, there was no contact. There was no worship in China above ground. The entire Chinese church had to go underground. The Christian vision of one body under heaven, which was a phrase that the Chinese Christians liked to use, was challenged by continuous class struggle targeted against Chinese Christians. In the U.S., China missionaries who had been especially close to the people were also caught up in the Cold War, and you get these divisions among missionaries between liberals and conservatives. Some missionaries were grilled by Joseph McCarthy, you know, in the anti-communism hearings of 1953, and so on. Now, the metaphor of friendship as exile can be illustrated by the Odyssey of John Layton Stewart, a fourth-generation Presbyterian missionary who ended his career in China as the last U.S. ambassador in China before all Americans were kicked out. Stewart was the first president of Yenching University in 1919. And under his administration, he was famous for the equality with which Chinese and Western staff treated each other. The people lived in identical houses. Chinese and Westerners lived together in the same area. And so that university was famous for the kind of vision of friendship that Stewart was trying to witness to as a counterexample to colonialism. He enforced equality and non-segregation. Now, his anti-imperialist activity included refusal to submit to the Japanese when they invaded China. So he was in prison during World War II for 4 years, imprisoned by the Japanese. Despite his lifetime of visible, concrete, particular solidarity with Chinese people, the changing tide of the Cold War discredited him. He was appointed U.S. ambassador in 1946, and he made the recommendation to the U.S. government that the U.S. should negotiate with communists, so he was withdrawn from China. Ironically, then, Mao Zedong condemned him as the arch symbol of Western imperialism. He was the last U.S. ambassador to China for 30 years. And in a famous statement called Farewell, Layton Stewart, Mao wrote that Stewart was always a, quote, always a loyal agent of U.S. cultural aggression in China, close quote. So here you see, he's caught between. You can't win. I mean, you know, his friendship put him right between superpowers. Back in the U.S., elderly and ill, Stewart lived for 13 years with Philip Fu, his Chinese assistant and close friend, who immigrated to the U.S. with Stewart in order to take care of him. For Stewart, lifelong friendship with Chinese people had turned into exile. Now, upon his death in 1962, Stewart wished to be buried in China next to his wife and his parents. But as the personal target of Mao, he remained the poster boy for American imperialism. Philip Fu, as friends, spent the rest of his life unsuccessfully trying to get Leighton Stewart buried in China. Now, the relationship of friendship between the Fu and Stewart continued to the next generation. Fu's son, John Fu, became the first Chinese-American military general for the U.S., and it took him 46 years. In 2008, General Fu was able to negotiate the burial of John Leighton Stewart next to his wife and parents in China, in Hangzhou. For Stewart, his long exile had ended. Now, the shifting meaning of John Leighton Stewart's relationships with the Chinese people shows the complexity of cross-cultural friendship in the light of Cold War politics. Stewart was persona non grata in China despite a lifetime of friendship. Yet the closeness of personal relationships was such that the Fu family moved to the U.S. with him and took care of him for the rest of his life. So this multi-generational friendship was defined, in a sense, more by Chinese than American culture, that kind of loyalty. And only after the political situation shifted past the divisions of the Cold War could the friendship between Stewart and the Chinese people be acknowledged with his reburial in China. This shows how cross-cultural friends paid the price outlined by Jesus. Misunderstood, suffering, and abused, they were in exile for each other. Now, here's another example. I'm going to look here at Milo Thornberry, who went to Taiwan as a missionary in 1967. And Thornberry and his wife became very close friends with Christian leaders, including the pro-democracy activist Peng Ming Min, who was the son of a Presbyterian pastor. Taiwan was governed by a military dictatorship, and the churches of Taiwan supported democratization. Thornberry supported the families of those arrested for pro-democracy activity. He worked with Amnesty International to report on conditions in Taiwanese prisons. In 1970, he and his wife smuggled Peng out of the country with fake papers and all kind of subterfuge. Because of his friendships with pro-democracy Christian leaders, Thornberry was expelled from Taiwan. But because Taiwan was a partner of the U.S., he got back to the U.S. and found himself stripped of his passport by the U.S. government for his, quote, pro-communist activity. Yet when Taiwan held its first free elections in 1996, after two decades in exile, Peng Ming Min was the presidential candidate from the opposition party. So look again, another example of how friendships and Christian solidarity got you in trouble, caught between political systems. The stories of the Fus and Stewart and Thornberry and Peng remind us that cross-cultural friendships can become exile for those who engage in it. You get attacked from both sides. As they were going along the road, someone said to him, "I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said to him, "The foxes have holes, and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." The second theme I'd like to examine as a reality of post-colonial mission is the movement from paternalism to partnership. By the late 1960s, the issue of economic inequality was becoming a front burner problem in the effort to eliminate colonialism in mission relationships. Missionaries controlled the money from the West and set the priorities. And there was turmoil. If you look at the theological struggle within mission in the 60s and 70s, it's just a huge literature of debating this missionary go home idea. Now, some mission scholars then trace the beginning of the post-colonial era in Mission to 1971, when Kenyan Presbyterian leader John Gatu called for a minimum 5-year moratorium on Western funds and personnel so that churches could find their own identities and so that relationships between Western and other churches could be renegotiated. John Gatu was a strong evangelical who lived for reconciliation, and he said in his testimony years later, he said, "At the very heart of revival is the statement, the reconciliation of man to God and person to person through Christ crucified. And outstanding among its fruits has been the reconciliation of races and tribes," close quote. So this man of great spiritual depth had many close relationships with Western mission friends. And he acted as a mentor to young people who went for short-term exposure experiences. And yet, he's the one who called for the end of Western missionaries for 5 years. So what is this? And his call was echoed by leaders from other parts of the world who had similar close relationships with Western missions. Methodist minister Emerito Nockpil called for the same, pointing out the inequality of churches from the West and the East. And he called missionaries a symbol of the universality of Western imperialism. So councils of churches throughout Asia, Latin America, and Africa called for a moratorium on missions. The missionized churches needed to stand on their own feet and to reject dependency. And the leader of the movement in Latin America was José Miguez Benigno, who's pictured here. So the idea here is that missionaries were guests in someone else's culture. And your guests should not be allowed to move in and take over your home. Even the nicest guests are supposed to go home. And, you know, the Didache for the early church says a preacher should stay 3 days or else he starts smelling like fish. You know, after 3 days, you've got to throw the evangelist out. So there's this kind of sense that the very people who had close relationships with Western missionaries were calling for a moratorium on missions. Now, although this so-called moratorium debate lasted only a few years, you know, it was a particular moment in time. It helped mark a paradigm shift in the mentality of missions. And this was a great spur to theologies of partnership. Rather than paternalism, mission relationships in a post-colonial frame should focus on partnership, sharing of resources, sharing of decision-making. The partnership ideal attacked the supposition that the white Westerner had the right to speak for the indigenous church or decide how to spend funds. Missionaries should work under local leadership. Mutuality, give and take, should replace the idea that mission was a one-way street from the West to the rest. And John Gatu remarked later that one of his purposes of calling for moratorium at that moment in history was to jolt Africans into realizing they had a missionary responsibility toward the rest of the world. Africans shouldn't sit back and be passive recipients of Western aid forever. And he was trying to motivate Africans to be more proactive about mission. He believed that at some point the people should realize that in some cases they were evangelizing regions that had been hearing the gospel for over a century, and it was time for the Africans to start sending missionaries to Europe. Now, in 1974, evangelical mission leaders met in Lausanne, Switzerland, and drew up the historic Lausanne Covenant. And if you've taken a mission class or have anything to do with mission, you know what that is. That's the basic assumption about the meaning of mission that is ascribed to by evangelical mission movements. And Billy Graham did yeoman's duty behind the scenes in making this Lausanne meeting come into being. In his opening speech, he condemned the call for moratorium. But Gatu was at the meeting and asked to meet with Billy Graham. And so there was a series of conversations between John Gatu and Billy Graham and John Stott and the other leaders who were writing the Lausanne Covenant. And the Lausanne Covenant then came to carry a phrase, quote, "A reduction of foreign missionaries and money in an evangelized country may sometimes be necessary to facilitate the national church's growth in self-reliance and to release resources for unevangelized areas. Missionaries should flow even more freely from and to all six continents in a spirit of humble service." So you have that written into the Lausanne Covenant in 1974. So what of friendship in this post-colonial practice of partnership? Certainly, cross-cultural friendship remained a possibility, but it had not solved the problem of structural inequalities in the world church. Although genuine friendship should emerge from relationships created through partnership, a new post-colonial spirituality required fairness and dignity and sharing for each partner, not necessarily personal intimacy. The post-colonial context demanded that the individual idiosyncrasies of friendship be replaced by structures of partnership. And you have a whole focus on partnership relationships that just pours out of especially mainline churches who had these big institutions in the colonial era and were giving them back over to the indigenous churches and then trying to figure out how to relate in that context. So partnership became the chief assumption, you could say, especially of mainline churches like Presbyterians, Methodists, and so on. During the 1970s and 80s, there was a real explosion of different kinds of partnership. And if you go Google mission partnership or something similar, you will find thousands and thousands of entries detailing all different types of partnerships, church-to-church partnerships, synod-to-synod partnerships, partnerships with NGOs and FBOs for specific purposes, cultural exchanges, short-term, exchange trips. So partnership has become a very important idea. Now, and partnership is less personal than friendship, if you think about it. You could actually be a partner with somebody and not even like them, actually. But as these partnership models have developed since the 1970s, we see that they actually, at their best, function on the same level as the idea of friendship. True partners are equals. They act together in a spirit of mutual respect. And I'd like to plug what I think is one of the best books on the theology of partnership, Sharon George's book called As Partners in Christ's Service. She was a Presbyterian mission partner in Brazil. And Sharon George defines partnership as sharing in love and sharing in grace. That's the basic definition of partnership that she puts forward in her work. She points out that the root of the part of the idea of partner refers to sharing something you have in common. As inheritors of God's grace in Jesus Christ, Christians partner with everyone who shares that common inheritance. God's movement toward the world and his compassion, as demonstrated in the incarnation, is the basis of partnership that she develops theologically. So partnership does not exclude the possibility of friendship. George points out that partnership can lead to friendship. Friendship requires respect, compassion, humility, sharing, praying, and waiting on God together. It requires giving and receiving. Unequal power politics remain a barrier both to partnership and to friendship as incarnational practice. Chris Hertz, founder of the group Word Made Flesh, a network of communities of young people who live among and serve the world's poor, writes in his book that it took him 20 years before he realized the importance of long-term commitments and what he called, quote, sustained friendship in community. So there's a rediscovery of friendship coming out of this idea of partnership that we see among younger generation mission groups, like Word Made Flesh. Now let me get to my third major category, self-theologizing as ecumenical mission praxis. Among the developments in post-colonial mission in the mid-20th century was the recognition of the fourth self of mission, namely that of self-theologizing. And mission scholars like Bob Schreider and others have talked about, and Paul Hebert talked about, this fourth self. So if you've taken a class with Dr. Stroop, you probably know that classic Anglo-American mission theory has focused on the founding of three self-churches. Churches should be self-supporting, self-governing, and self-propagating, or in other words, capable of sending their own missions. And what you see, though, is that self-theologizing was not one of the selves. That the church was supposed to be the mission to found and plant new churches. The churches were supposed to be independent, pay their own minister, run their own affairs, but they sure had better be carbon copies of the theology of the Western church that founded them. So self-theologizing was not looked upon very favorably. And because of this, what you found is by the early 20th century, many indigenous or independent churches breaking off of missions because a minister would be frustrated and would have a different theological message, and then with the issue of power dynamics would break off and found an independent church. So by 1970, though, this new post-colonial mindset made many mission folks realize that maybe self-theologizing should be part of an ecumenical theological discourse, and that self-theologizing is also a building block for the development of the world church. Now, what was the role of cross-cultural friendship in the creation of contextual theologies? For one thing, there was a great development of new mission spiritualities. And here I'm just pointing to one. This is a picture of Canon Max Warren, head of the Church Missionary Society, in this period of post-colonialism. And if you know, the CMS was one of the largest missions in the colonized regions. You know, Great Britain was a huge colonial power, and the CMS was the major mission of the Church of England in those colonies. So that church had a lot of reflection to do on the issue of colonialism. And Max Warren was the head of the CMS in that mid-20th century period. He advocated a new spirituality based on what he called a theology of attention, of listening, and of Christian presence. And this idea of Christian presence was supposed to replace the aggressiveness of non-listening with the act of being with others. Mission relationships in the post-colonial age required respect for the traditions and cultures of others, and the missionary should be a humble learner. Now, the most famous phrase, probably, coming out of Max Warren's prolific writings in the 50s and 60s about Christian presence, and is this one: our first task in approaching another people, another culture, another religion, is to take off our shoes, for the place we are approaching is holy. And that phrase was very important to a lot of the missionaries of the 1960s, as they realized that that the situation shifted and they needed to be humble listeners and learners in order to be partners with people in a basis of equality in a post-colonial era. Now, based on then this spirituality, rather than the idea of colonial control, you have a wide amount of attention on facilitating self-theologizing, that this may be needed to be the task of a missionary partner, is self-theologizing. And here I'm just going to run through some of these before I select the one that I'm going to spend time talking about as my illustration of this. And this should jog your memory for some of you who've studied this period. For one thing, you had ecumenical networking through things like the Theological Education Fund or the Fund for Theological Education in Southeast Asia. There were funds to support leadership training in churches around the world in the 1960s and 70s, 50s, 60s, 70s. So these funds that the Western Church sent to facilitate leadership training and the founding of new seminaries was one effort to help with the task of self-theologizing. In 1972, Protestant theological educators in Southeast Asia concretized a self-theologizing framework when they adopted the critical Asian principle. Now, these were Asian theologians who said that they needed to identify what was, quote, distinctly Asian in order to use that distinctiveness as a critical principle of judgment on matters dealing with the life and mission of the Christian community, theology, and theological education in Asia, close quote. So there's a movement among Asian Christian leaders to say, when we do theology, let's look at it through our, quote, Asian lens and see what it looks like from that perspective. The coining of the word contextualization comes from this period, 1972. Where the Taiwanese theologian Shoki Ko reinforced that indigenous theology should be the foundation for an emerging world Christian movement. And I know when you take a mission class, you are familiar with the word contextualization because this concept has been widely accepted now across the board in churches now, that we look at contextualization as a framework for theologizing and for mission work. In 1970, evangelical Latin American theologians, Rene and Catherine Padilla, Samuel Escobar, Pedro Arana, Jose Miguez Benino, and others founded the Latin American Theological Fraternity as an evangelical Latin American group to do evangelical Latin American theology. And they had missionary friend partners, people like Andrew Kirk and Sidney Rui, who raised money for them in order to launch the FTL. And this group is still going strong. It developed its own theological education program. It's facilitating the training in Pentecostal churches in El Salvador and other places. Then, as I mentioned yesterday, you had in 1973 the publication of Gustavo Gutierrez's A Theology of Liberation as an act of self-theologizing. Partnership was essential here, too. For one thing, it had to be translated into English. Secondly, Orbis Books is a mission press, and they have never turned a profit. The donations of the faithful pay for the publication of all the liberation theology and third world theology and all of that contextual theology that Orbis Press has published, and they've never turned a profit. So that was a service. That's another dimension of the hidden partnerships here, the hidden friendship theme to help facilitate self-theologizing. Now I want to come to the group that I want to focus on in the rest of my time with you, which is that of African indigenous churches. And there were three major movements in the mid-20th century to facilitate self-theologizing among AICs. By the late 1960s, mission scholar David Barrett had shown that there were over 6,000 indigenous denominations throughout Africa. And the definition of these churches is churches founded by Africans in Africa for Africans. Often these churches focus on healing, visions, the exorcism of evil spirits. They often continued African customs that were not allowed in mission churches, such as polygamy and authoritarian leadership patterns. Now, most of the scholarship on AICs in the 1960s said they were syncretistic, heretical bridges back to heathenism and not real forms of Christianity. But this new post-colonial mentality is sweeping in, and some younger generation of missionaries decide to work with AICs. And so I'm going to mention these efforts as partnership efforts for self-theologizing in which friendship emerged. The first I want to mention is the significant Mennonite model. For 30 years, Mennonites have had an ecumenical mission of helping AICs refine their theology without trying to turn them into Mennonites. You see, that's the point, is mission willing to help people with their own theological identity rather than just seeing them as an opportunity to sign up new members of your own brand? And the Mennonites made a decision that they would work ecumenically to help the AICs. And so this couple, the Weavers, who had been missionaries in India, went to Ghana and began surveying AICs and then launched this movement. Dozens of Mennonite missionaries served AICs by conducting Bible studies in local languages, co-writing Bible guides with African church leaders, helping facilitate leadership training, all of which were the felt needs of the AICs. The Mennonite model did not focus on friendship. It was a partnership model. It said, no, friendship is too intimate. This is not what we're going for. We're going for partnership. So it's working to equip leaders. Nevertheless, today, there are more African Mennonites than there are Western Mennonites. So even though the Mennonites were not trying to make new Mennonites, it happened anyway. The Mennonite movement continues to grow in Africa. Now, a second major initiative that is well documented, or that it's very important as one of these three important ones, was a relationship of friendship between Swiss missionary Marie-Louise Martin and Joseph D'Angenda, the youngest son of Simon Kimbangu. I do not have a picture of Marie-Louise Martin. I couldn't find one. And part of that is indicative of how she buried herself in her work among the Kimbanguis. And the Kimbanguist church was the largest AIC in Africa in the 1960s and 70s. And it was founded in 1921 by the Congolese prophet Simon Kimbangu, who was a Baptist who only preached for 6 months before being arrested by Belgian authorities and who then imprisoned him for 30 years because of the fear that an indigenous church would lead to revolution. The Belgian authorities dispersed thousands of his followers throughout the Congo, and wherever his followers were dispersed to, it became the seedbed for the growth of the church. His youngest son eventually consolidated the movement, and when it was unbanned in 1959, he led this movement until his death in 2001. Now, Marie-Louise Martin was an experienced theological educator in Lesotho who was very critical of AICs as syncretists. She especially criticized their tendency toward messianism, where the individual leader becomes a kind of power broker. But then in 1968, she visited the headquarters of the Kimbanguists on behalf of the World Council of Churches because the church had applied for membership. And there she entered into a friendship with Kimbangu's son, who then asked her to found a theological seminary for the Kimbanguists, which she did in 1970. She got support from Swiss Moravians and other sources. By 1975, the seminary had 83 students and 7 full-time professors. Now, the goal of this movement was to develop indigenous Kimbangoist theology while simultaneously keeping the theology in the conversation of orthodoxy. So you see, if churches are just independent and develop their own theology and never relate to any other part of the church, all of us would go off on a tangent. You need to have communal accountability in your theology, even as it's self-theologizing. So that was her task. And she finally died in 1990. And this is a book she wrote on Simone Kimbangu. Now, sadly, one could say the Kimbanguist movement has become heterodox in the years since the death of this youngest son. And it's now a kind of messianic, where the leader now said he's the second coming of Jesus Christ and that kind of thing. What does that tell you, though? It says self-theologizing is something that's always in motion. You know, it's never steady. It's never still. It's theological movements are always moving and developing. And we have to keep re-engaging at any point that we can. And the Mennonite theologian David Shank wrote in 1885, when he described these movements, that the long-term building of relationships of trust, openness, and reciprocity are the hardest but both most effective good news that an expatriate missionary can communicate. Now, I'm going to have to speed through the next part, where I wanted to talk about the work of my husband, Enos Daniil, who's considered one of the great motivators for self-theologizing. He spent 1965 through 1980 in the liberation struggle. He was fluent in Shona, and he had the vision of creating an ecumenical movement among AICs in Zimbabwe. He was accused of treason by the White Smith regime for refusing to bear arms against the Shona. In 1972, in the middle of the civil war in Zimbabwe, what's now Zimbabwe, he and 12 AIC leaders founded the African Independent Church Conference to provide a theological education by extension program in self-theologizing. In the midst of the civil war, 15,000 people completed Bible training and self-theology training under Fambazano. And Enos was protected. I'm just jumping through this. He was adopted by the founder of the Zionist Church, Samuel Mutendi, who became his father. And when Mutendi was arrested by the Rhodesian government and charged again in the docket, Enos sat in the docket with the Mutendi family and bailed them out. Nevertheless, being white, he risked his life whenever he went into the countryside where black guerrillas were fighting. And here's one of his closest friends, Bishop Forage. Bishop Forage was the bishop of an African independent church. And whenever my husband would go into rural areas to do Bible training, Forage would have him protected so that he wouldn't be killed as a white person going into the black areas. When the Rhodesian Defense Forces attacked Bishop Forage's village, they burned down his hut, arrested Forage, and Forage, the only thing he managed to save from his hut was his theological education certificate that he had on the wall from the TEE program that meant so much to him. The Rhodesian forces tortured Forage, he lost his hearing and suffered other permanent damage. What this says is it reminds you again is that living in mutual friendship in situations of revolution is not a dinner party. It means standing up for each other. No one has greater love than this to lay down one's life for one's friends. And being friends across boundaries in a situation of revolution is an act of faith in the kingdom of God, an act of faith. After the Civil War ended and independent Zimbabwe emerged, and together my husband and other churches, indigenous churches, founded what became the largest grassroots tree planting movement in southern Africa called Zircon, which for 15 years planted up to 1 million trees a year for reforestation so that people could regain the lands that they had lost during the war by replenishing the earth. Today, the multicultural, multi-generational relationship continues, and this is in us with Bishop Nehemiah Mutendi, the son of Samuel Mutendi, his adopted father. Nehemiah Mutendi has built a huge headquarters for the Zion Christian Church in Bungo that seats 15,000 people. And about 5 years ago, Enos preached at their Easter sermon, preached his Easter sermon. Again, the only white person amidst 15,000 to 20,000 people. So these cross-racial relationships, even though the politics changes, the relationships continue. And this is the star, the Zapota star, at the top of the huge cathedral that Mutendi has built. Let me conclude. In these Parchman lectures, I began by asking the question, what world Christianity would look like if it were told as a history of cross-cultural friendships? And I've explored several dimensions of that, as a global missional ethic, as a vision of fellowship, and finally, as a persistent theme in a post-colonial framework. We see that friendship is not easy or cheap. It results in exile. It results in being ostracized, of being accused of treason, and being martyred. And the paradox of friendship is that it is an end in itself. It is not a means to something else. In the historical record, it remains a hidden dimension of kingdom hope, like the mustard seed that has not yet grown into a tree. Yet through it, piece by piece, the world community of Christians comes into being. As we reflect on the difficulties of friendship in these days of Ferguson, the 50th anniversary of Selma, of ISIS, of Boko Haram, the war on terrorism, and all the struggles of our day, it seems appropriate to conclude with the words of a certain Baptist minister, also speaking in the age of Cold War and decolonization, who, of course, is the most famous alum of my school. In 1957, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. addressed the Conference on Christian Faith and Human Relations in Nashville on the subject, The Role of the Church Facing the Nation's Chief Moral Dilemma. Speaking of the nonviolent protests in the civil rights movement, King said, But the end is reconciliation. The end is redemption. The end is the creation of the beloved community. It is this type of spirit and this type of love that can transform opposers into friends. So in King's beloved community, friendship is a sign pointing to God's reign. In Christ, there is no east or west, in him no south or north, but one great fellowship of love throughout the whole wide earth.